attacked two people. We actually attacked the woman first, and then the police came.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to open up the morning's hearing for the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have four bills that are scheduled for public hearing, and a couple of them, I believe, can be going in the work session. We're going to start off at the bottom of the list, Senate Bill 464, and I'm going to ask Council if you give us a little overview on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 464 prohibits the use or attempted use of a name of a recording group for advertising a live performance if a member of the group is not performing. Provides exceptions, makes violation an unlawful practice, authorizes a private right of action and attorney general action for actual damages or $200, whichever is greater. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. We have two distinguished individuals that are going to be giving us testimony on the beginning. John Bowser Bauman and Johnny Etheridge. Gentlemen, why don't y'all come on up, and we'll see if there's anyone else who wants to testify after that. And we'll let you decide on who's going to go first.
I actually want to go first. And I am John Bauman, better known as Bowser, formerly of the musical group Sha Na Na. And since you said I was distinguished, I probably shouldn't do this.
That's okay. That's okay.
I will anyway, because people want you to do it. Anyway, I am Bowser, but I'm here in an entirely different capacity. I'm here as the chair of the Truth in Music Committee at the Vocal Group Hall of Fame. And I'm here because since I left Sean and I've been doing shows called Bowser's Rock and Roll Party or Bowser's Ultimate Doo-Wop Party. And I've had, on these shows, I have often had guests of the authentic artists of the 50s and the 60s. And I've watched this problem develop over the course of really 25 years and just gotten worse, and watched this problem get worse and worse and worse, which is a proliferation of these imposter groups, groups that really have no connection to the authentic artist at all and don't own the name. And somehow this sort of cottage industry is built up where, particularly with regard to the old-timers, although there have been cases of modern groups as well, but particularly with regard to groups like the Coasters, the Platters, the Drifters, the real pioneer groups who were nameless and kind of faceless at the time. You know, it was a different era. There was no music video. The groups were largely the most victimized groups, had the most hit records of the era, and were also African-American groups. Sometimes the record companies wouldn't even put their pictures on the cover of the album, as Johnny will attest. So you didn't know who the individuals were. And as a result, you know, we've reached a point where people are kind of sticking any four people up on stage and calling them the Platters and duping the public, taking the public's money. First and foremost, the bill is a consumer bill. The public pays good money to go see something that it thinks is the group or at least has some connection to this group. And in fact, they're simply getting ripped off. You know, it's a tribute show and it needs to call itself such. And this has been going on now for a long time, and as I said, gotten worse and worse and worse. It's really a strange and sophisticated form of identity theft. In the meantime, the public, while the public gets ripped off, the authentic artists are sitting at home wanting to work that night, you know, and these people consequently are taking their jobs, their legacy, and for performers, almost worst of all, their applause. Sometimes you know, I've gotten involved in this enough to go to some of these shows and see what happens. And there's sort of a something that I call the real one, where they'll go see something called the Platters, which happened here recently in a casino. They'll pay to go see something called the Platters. So then there's like three 35-year-old guys up there and one 70-year-old guy, because this is something, you know, done fairly astutely. So the audience will sit there going, well, those guys are too young, but, oh, he must be the real one. And, you know, yeah, he's a real 70-year-old guy, but he's a real 70-year-old guy who has absolutely nothing to do with the Platters. And, you know, the audience often comes out dumbfounded, doesn't know, as Johnny will attest to, he has specific things that he overheard at that recent show. They don't even know what they saw. They don't know whether they got taken, they didn't get taken. And it's something that's proved very hard to stop. until the Truth in Music Bill came along. We have blissfully passed this bill in 27 states, and we've made a significant dent. The enforcement has not been difficult. It's been enforced. There have been enforcement actions, about 10 enforcement actions, in mostly in the earlier states in which the bill was passed. The enforcement actions have been effective. The venues end up being the first line of defense because they don't want to get that call from the Attorney General's office saying, you know, we think you may have a show here that's in violation of the Truth in Music Bill. So what happens is the venues end up doing much better due diligence as to who they've got on the stage. And the bill is very clear. It just says you need to have a recording member, somebody who is on the records, who has a continuing right to use the name, in the group that's put on that stage that night before the public, unless somehow you are the holder of a valid federally registered trademark for that name, in which case that's an issue that's got to be fought out at the Patent and Trademark Office, and it's completely sideways in the Truth in Music Bill. If you don't have a recording member of the performing group, you need to call yourself a tribute and stop duping the public. The public will then pay tribute group ticket prices, which are always lower. They will know what they're getting to see, and if they want to hear, you know, the music of ABBA, they'll know they're not seeing ABBA, they're seeing, you know, abracadabra, and it's fine. It's no harm, no foul. So it's pretty simple and straightforward law that actually the end result ends up saving the state money, because if issues come up where there does have to be action with regard to this, it's very clearly defined.
Great. Well, thank you. Before we take questions, Johnny Etheridge, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, then we'll open it up for the any discussion.
Sure. I've been in the broadcasting business since 1970 in Eugene as Jive and Johnny Etheridge, and I've hosted an oldies show since that time. And as a regular part of my oldies program, I have guest interviews on the show with many of these early pioneers of the early rock and roll era. And I seek them out by telephone and in person. I also never miss a chance to go see an oldies act in person when I have the chance. And I remember well some of the first ones I saw in Oregon, which isn't exactly the entertainment capital of the world. So you may ask yourself, why is a bill like this necessary in Oregon? But you'd be surprised how many opportunities there are for the public to see pioneer groups here in Oregon. And that opportunity is increasing with the increasing number of Indian casinos throughout the state, because all of these casinos are new entertainment venues giving acts new opportunities to perform. But I remember very well over 35 years ago the first time I went to see the Platters at a now defunct place called Fred and Shirley's Supper Club in Springfield. And I sat there and realized that there were no Platters in that group. And I was young and aggressive, and so I confronted the group during a break and said, I just have one question. What do you guys have to do with the Platters? And one of the men in the group gave me an answer. He said, nothing. We're just carrying on the name. And at the time, I was sort of satisfied with that answer because I presumed that by carrying on the name, the original Platters didn't exist. But now, after the fact, because more information is available, especially through the internet, I realized that at the time, the real Platters did exist with a couple of original members in the group. They weren't carrying on the name, they were stealing the name. And it happened in the early 70s at the Oregon State Fair when I went to see the Drifters and realized there's no Drifters on that stage. There could have been. The Drifters were likely performing someplace in America that night, just not in Salem, Oregon. And I can recall that on a trip back east in Baltimore, I went to see the Coasters, and I was working briefly at a radio station there, and so because of the radio station involvement, I was able to share a table with the Coasters during their breaks. And it was the real Coasters, and Carl Gardner, a founding member since 1956, shared with me at that
and
time.
Trademark holder, by the way. And he's the holder of a valid fair. He's just been bankrupted by this. He hasn't been able to survive. Sorry.
That's okay. He shared with me as far back as 1973 his dismay at the number of fake Coasters groups running around the country. And when I returned back to the West Coast, I found that to be true because I got a job at KASH in Eugene, which sponsored an oldie show at a downtown nightclub featuring the Coasters. And I was excited. I'm going to see my old friend Carl Gardner again, and we're going to reminisce about fun times in Baltimore, and we're going to have a great time, and I'm going to be the MC. And lo and behold, here's this group that I've never seen a single face in this group, and there's nobody there that's ever been a coaster, and my name is attached to it and on the posters, and I was rather humiliated and embarrassed. But I had to go on with it like a good soldier because I'm working for the radio station. And during the meet and greet, when fans are asking these guys questions, they can't even answer the questions. How could they? They weren't there. They're not the group. And the same thing happened in the early 70s at a South Eugene High School concert. The same thing happened in the mid-70s when I traveled as far away as Roseburg to see the coasters, and every time I'd see them, it was a different group. Let's fast forward to more recent years when entertainment has become so common at Oregon's Indian casinos. There is a group called the Cornell Gunter Coasters, which has been in existence since the early 60s. And I've seen them four times in recent years at Oregon casinos. One group two times, another group two times. The real Cornell Gunter coasters twice, a fake group of Cornell Gunters twice. So it's kind of a, well, to take a phrase from the Indian casinos, it's kind of a crapshoot as to who you're going to see when you line up to see these groups. Just as recently as a couple of weeks ago, the last week of January, I went to an Indian casino to see a group of platters. I had seen a fake group of platters earlier at an Indian casino in Oregon. It particularly galled me to hear that group constantly refer to themselves in the first person as, "When we recorded this." And you know, I'd almost come out of my seat every time. But I restrained myself. I didn't know who I was going to see down in Canyonville, but I overheard in the lobby a fan with an album by the Real Platters ask the concierge, "Is Zola Taylor going to be here tonight?" She was the original female member of the group. And the concierge says, "Gee, I don't know, maybe." Well, I avoided butting in to saying, "No, she's not. She's deceased." So the fan then asks, "Well, how many originals are going to be here?" And the concierge says, "Well, I don't know. At least one." And I avoided butting in to say, "Well, that's not true either, because I've already Googled it, and there's only one original still alive, and he's working on the East Coast tonight. And there's only one former lead singer of the Platters still working, and he's working elsewhere tonight elsewhere. And I can guarantee you that I don't know who you're going to hear tonight, but it's not going to be the Platters." And so by the end of the show, as I'm watching the crowd leaving, I see a different fan, elderly couple, walking out, husband and wife apparently, but a couple. And the woman says to the man, "Aren't you going to stick around and get your album autographed?" And he seemed pretty ticked off. "Hell no, not by this group." He was taken, and he knew it. Now, how is that possible that groups can do that? Well, in the early days of rock and roll, albums weren't the primary medium for the consumer. 45s were, and unless you were on a major label and white and cute, you didn't get a picture sleeve 45. The 45 came in a plain white or brown piece of paper, and that was that. You didn't know what the group looked like. And even if you did get the album, if you were an African-American group, it was very possible that your photograph was often not put on the album. You got a generic cartoon drawing album cover like this one by the Coasters, which shows a roller coaster and a bunch of blonde-haired people down at the bottom here, or this one by the Drifters, which shows a bunch of happy people dancing, and this one by the Drifters with no photo at all, or this one by the Drifters, which is one of the later ones, which at least seems to indicate that these people may be African Americans, but it's still just a cartoon drawing. And there are exceptions to this, of course, but this is quite common for many of the pioneer groups. They were nameless, they were faceless. They just had the name of the group. And so it's only from the mid-60s onwards that a typical fan could name and who the Rolling Stones are and what they look like, and could name who the Beach Boys are and what they look like. For these early groups, listen, put four people together, call them the Platters. For the average consumer, that's the Platters. In Oregon, when you buy a carton of orange juice, it's supposed to have orange juice on the inside, not Tang. And if that happened, it would be against the law. When you go to see the Platters, you should get the Platters.
Thank you very much. I want to open up for any questions.
Senator Westhead. Thank you, Senator Prudensky. Two questions. One, Is the venue where the performance occurs liable to the Fair Practices Act under this bill? And the second question is, will this bill have jurisdiction on Native American sovereign land?
We have to look at your language. You should look at your language right now. Theoretically, the venue could be liable. Our recommendation always is that the liability really should lie with the ultimately with the perpetrators, you know, the promoters or producers and the agents that book this thing in. The venue is usually who gets the first call, and they'll turn it over to the AG's office. They'll turn over the information of where they got the act from to the AG's office. There is one state in America that altered the language to stop the venues from being liable, and that state is Nevada. That's been the only really substantive change in the bill the entire time through the 27 states. We think the bill is stronger if the venue thinks that it can be on the hook, because they will do better due diligence of who they put in there. But the bill will work either way, in all candor. Where this should be stopped is at the level of the people who put the show out. And the agents is, see, the one problem here is that the venues are often victims. They don't know what they're buying either. They can do a better job of looking into it than they've done in the past. But much like the public, venues tend to trust agents that they characteristically do business with. And, you know, they develop relationships of trust over a period of years. And, you know, then this kind of becomes their, if it's an agent that you've trusted over a long period of time and they sell you something, it gets you in trouble. It kind of becomes, what did you do to me here, you know, from the venue point of view? That's a perfectly legitimate question. Your second part of your question, I can't answer. You have a better chance of knowing the answer to that than we do. The sovereign land issue.
I'd like to interject that in the modern era, agents go
to great lengths to hide the fact that they are presenting fake groups.
By hiding the individual identities of their group members when the group is indeed a fake group. I've brought along with me CD covers being sold at venues by currently operating fake groups, and the interesting thing about these CD covers is that none of them contain photographs of the group. They all feature cartoon character drawings of African Americans or simply a stylized silhouette drawing. And so the agents sponsoring these fake groups are clearly taking steps to hide the identity of the fact that they're presenting a fake group. So
we're not interested in penalizing venues for this, if that is a simple answer to this question. A venue could end up having a problem. The venue will end up having a problem insofar as it's going to lose a show that night. You know, if there's an enforcement action to be had with regard to this, and really from the venue point of view, unless they are the producers of the show and really knowingly, willingly, and with their eyes open are violating this law, there really isn't culpability on their part. So that's something we're perfectly happy for you to look at.
Right. Senator Bolamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are they all booked through agents?
Pretty much always. Always is probably a pretty fair statement. And the agents also pretty well always know what it is they're booking. The real culpability here is from the source itself, which may be the group itself and may not be the group itself. It may be there's one very well-worked organization that really is the one Johnny's talking about. Probably every show that Johnny has referred to comes from the same source in New York that's turned this into an industry. And you will have, often, there's a Coasters, Platters, Drifters show. The Drifters we've taken care of already, they're gone. They replaced them with something called Legendary Lead Singers of the Temptations. They're gone. We've made great inroads into this stopping this one organization. But it started out as Coasters, Rifters, Platters. Okay. You could see, technically, it was Ellsbury, Hobbs, Drifters, Cornell, Gunther's, Coasters, and the Platters. They had no rights to any of these names, and no one, they were stone cold illegal on the Truth and Music, if the Truth and Music Bill had existed. The nature of the abuse was, you could go see the Coasters, Drifters, Platters in, you know, at the Oregon State Fair at 8 p.m. You could see, and on the same night, you could see them at the Sahara Hotel in Las Vegas at 8 p.m., and at the same night, you could see them in Tampa, Florida at 8 p.m., and at the same night, you could see them in New Hampshire at 8 p.m., and that's the nature of the abuse. That's not really the venue's fault. It's really the fault of the group that's putting these phony groups out and knows exactly what it's doing, and the agents that continue to book it, because you should understand, really, I'll give you just the thumbnail of this. These groups undercut any kind of normal pricing, as you can well imagine. I mean, what you do is, if you called them up for New Year's Eve, like I just said, and you said, okay, I've got a private party, I want the Platters on New Year's Eve, are they available? The answer, of course, is yes, because if you have 15 New Year's Eve dates, you just put together a 16th group, you find four more guys, pay them $200 a piece, stick them on a stage, and call them the Platters. So these groups are very, very inexpensive. Agents can buy them from this source for virtually no money at all. Then the agent turns around and sells them to the Oregon State Fair. You know, this group has, this package has 120 hit records. The agent sells it to the Oregon State. The agent buys it for, you know, $7,500 and sells it to the Oregon State Fair for $25,000, keeps the other 80. Agents are supposed to get 10%. You know, this agent got 600% or, you know, 1,000%. And that's part of the nature of the problem, just so you understand the details.
All right. Other questions? All right. And just for clarification, I think we can go ahead and put on the record under subsection or under section 3, subsection 2, lines 8 on page 2, actually states a person may not use or attempt to use the name of a recording group in advertising or presenting a live musical performance or production in which a group other than the recording group performs. Then the subsection 3 goes through the exceptions that we've already had put on the testimony. So to answer your question, Senator Wissett, it would appear to me that anyone that is part of bringing a group forward, advertising that this group is something that they're not, could in fact be within the line of liability. Counselor, would you disagree?
Okay. And I agree as well. That's really the way the bill is written. But again, that's something, if you care to look at it, it's not a problem for us. Our overall thing is to get at the source.
Understood. All right. So, and regarding the other question about Native American or sovereign nation land, I think that's something we should just to see exactly so we know before we vote on this. So, is it no other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 464? Not seeing anyone. And Mr. Bauman, I want to thank you very much for traveling here. I know that you made an effort to get here to Oregon, and I appreciate you taking the time to give us the testimony you gave us today. And we will not be moving the bill today, but we'll be looking at these couple of questions, and it's the intent that once we get those, to bring it back for a work session.
And it's my pleasure, you know, to be here. My daughter moved here anyway from New York, so I'm going to go visit her in Portland tonight, so that's wonderful, although I would be here anyway. You know, we certainly don't want these groups suddenly only doing shows in states that don't have the Truth in Music law.
So is there any place in Portland we should be at tonight just for a guest appearance that you might want to have?
This is going to be entirely personal, but as far as the guest appearance is concerned, I do want to say, bum 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 bum, dang 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 dang, thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we'll close the public hearing. That definitely should make the tape.
You don't get that. Change of counsel.
Goodbye.
All right. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on...
Never a boring moment in judiciary.
I didn't expect that in judiciary.
I'm afraid that the chair of Consumer Protection is probably now mad at me that we stole a consumer and ID bill from. But we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 251. And
I'm only glad I didn't miss this experience this morning, Mr. Chair.
So, Council, if you give us an overview on Senate Bill 251.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 251 modifies the crime of phone and possession of a restricted weapon to include tasers, and the Dash 1 amendments that you have in front of you would include mace, tear gas, and similar agents. We do not yet have the fiscal impact statements or the revenue back on the Dash 1 amendments, but the initial report was a minimal expenditure.
I would call someone up to give testimony, but I'm waiting for the list. Is that performance? Or we could take a show of hands. Brad, come on up.
Felon transmission. This is only about the felons. This is only felons.
That's what I thought, convicted of felony, but I want to make sure.
Chair Krasanski, members of the committee, I'm Brad Berry, I'm Hill County District Attorney.
This is a hard act to follow, I know. So.
And I was just going to, let me finish introducing myself, and chair of the ODA, Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. Two things. One, not only is that a hard act to follow, but my voice has never been that low in my entire life. So that was quite interesting. I was glad I was here to watch that. Senate Bill 251, I've got to get myself organized here for a moment. Got myself off track. Basically provides for adding to the definition of restricted or prohibited weapons for felons the electromuscular disruption technology device, and I will use shorthand TASER, which is technically a product name, much like Coca-Cola would be a cola beverage. ORS 166-270 generally prohibits convicted felons from possessing firearms and other dangerous weapons, including switchblades, blackjacks, metal knuckles, and the like. The common theme of many of these weapons is the ability of the offender to quickly exert force to stop another or rapidly change the dynamics of a confrontation. In recent years, the availability of tasers has increased, as well as the willingness of felons to actually have and use these weapons. As a couple of examples, the Oregon State Police executed a search warrant on a drug dealer's home and in fact found, as it was described to me, a cache of tasers within the home that the drug dealer was going to use for his protection and to protect his wares. Washington County case, wherein men were hired to take care of a drug debt, used a taser to immobilize the victim before ultimately killing him. A Multnomah County case involved Ukrainian mob or gang members who were hired to go collect a debt of some $50,000, $60,000. When getting to the debtor, they kicked him and beat him, and ultimately, as police were arriving, utilized a taser to disable him while they fled the scene. And lastly, a Washington County case involved a case where a felon was stealing from a store, was apprehended or approached by the loss prevention officer, the security person in a retail store, and stopped, and the felon attempted to use a taser against the loss prevention officer to prohibit him from being apprehended. Senate Bill 251 would add tasers to the list of prohibited weapons for felons. It really continues to recognize the sound reasoning of prohibiting felons from having weapons while bringing the statute up to date with current weapon technology not in existence or readily accessible when the statute was last modified. That, in its simplistic terms, is what this does.
All right, thank you. Kevin?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm also here to support Senate Bill 251. And similar to District Attorney Berry, we've received a lot of stories from the field of an increasing prevalence of tasers that they're running into in different environments in kind of a wide range of settings and used for a wide range of purposes, everything from used for torture to situations where they're used to steal bicycles. They're beginning to show up out there, and as Brad Berry mentioned, this is a way for us to keep up with new technologies that we find in the field that represent a danger to the public and the public safety officers. The stories involving the use of tasers and similar technologies to incapacitate intended victims of crime are more and more common, and they result in an increased amount of victimization. But for law enforcement officers, it's also extremely dangerous because it quickly elevates an encounter to a deadly force situation. Tasers have the ability to render an officer incapable of self-defense from attack and makes the officer's firearm accessible to the perpetrator for use against them. There are laws throughout the United States right now attempting to deal with the prevalence of tasers. Seven states and the District of Columbia outlaw them for personal use altogether. This bill just prevents possession of this technology by felons, and I think that's a wise policy, and we hope that the committee will support this change in policy and the addition of tasers.
All right, thank you. First question, that's going to go Senator Boyquist, and we'll come back across.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, gentlemen, I think you've seen the Dash One Amendment. And I guess my only question is it logical to assume if we outlaw the tasers, they're going to grab whatever else is legal and they're going to use what's covered in the Dash One and start using it instead?
Chair Prezansky, Senator Boquist, and members of the committee, I think we would be Pollyannish to say that felons aren't going to find something to use as a weapon. We're not going to outlaw dictionaries because they could swing one in an officer, obviously. What I think a taser does, it is different, and even the items included in the Dash 1 amendments, which have been explained to me, I've not read it, but I understand what it includes, are those instruments which can quickly change the dynamics of the altercation. Taking the time to grab a book and swing it, for example, at an officer or a member of the public, a victim-to-be, takes more time, and the dynamics of the confrontation change much more slowly than they do with the other weapons which are currently prohibited, as well as the ones we're suggesting be added to the statute now.
Mr. Campbell, why don't you go first, then we'll come back.
Chair Prezansky and Senator Boquist, we support the Dash 1 amendments. I think it actually creates a similar situation in the field. It does put people at risk, and it can disable an officer in a similar manner and also put them in a situation where the weapon may be accessible to someone. So,
Mr. Chair, for a follow-up for the rest of the committee, I mean, we use some of these sorts of things in military training that I conduct, and for frankly, better word, you can buy a tear gas gun, which is, of course, you can buy tasers now that shoot from here to where the district attorney's doing. You don't even have to get next to them anymore.
Right.
And you can now buy virtually dozens of places online tear gas guns where you can shoot from here to there, which have the same endangerment issues that we're trying to resolve with this bill here.
All right. Senator Wissett.
Thank you. Senator Boquist addressed part of the issue. Does this bill, particularly with the Dash 1 amendments, actually prohibit female felons from virtually any means of self-defense? And felons can be come in all different shapes and sizes, but I mean, you can be a felon and not really have ever done anything violent in your life. So I'm wondering if with the Dash 1, if it's a little bit too broad in that it could prevent someone from protecting themselves. For instance, a female felon who was convicted of
stealing suspended money.
You know, I mean, what I'm saying, I mean, I'm losing the word.
It could be white collar crime, some yes, type of yeah. Fraud, uh-huh. Maybe even driving while suspended at a felony level. I think that's what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Chair Prezansky, Senator Whitsett, members of the committee, I'll let those who are proponents of the Dash 1 explain more in there. The taser issue was one that came from the DA's Association. And I was obviously clearly ready to address those issues here. And this isn't exactly your question, Senator, and I recognize that, but I would suggest that clearly a taser is a different type of weapon than the others. But the issue comes, I think, down to one of the ability of someone to disable a police officer. And I think that's what Mr. Campbell was addressing. When we talk about things such as pepper spray, mace, even tear gas in the broader sense, as Senator Boquist discussed it, it's what happens with the officer. And what we certainly don't want to see is a situation elevating from one that could be controlled by an officer through their chaining as they elevate in the use of force against a particular individual, not having to go to the issue of deadly force. And one of the things, this is a bit on as an aside, one of the things that I think is most advantageous about law enforcement officers now carrying tasers is they have a non-lethal weapon that has the ability to stop a perpetrator in their tracks without having to even pull their firearm to do that. Now going to the point of a felon to whom they now find themselves in an encounter, what we don't want is the felon having the ability to drop a police officer through a non-lethal means, a taser, for example, and completely render them helpless, and at the same time then exposing a firearm to the situation that the felon would then be able to reach down and get. Now, the rapidity with which tear gas or mace or pepper spray incapacitate an officer, I suppose we could genuinely debate that and whether or not it is as quick and the ability of the officer to respond. And again, I'm not readily capable of answering your question there, whether or not that is the case. And lastly, are there other means by which a felon could protect themselves beyond this? I just point out that the statute currently prohibits the possession of lots of kinds of weapons, in particular knives, which are slower in oftentimes, not always, are slower and provide an officer or a victim more time to respond. Let's be honest, though, a hidden knife is just as lethal and just as surprising to a victim or an officer as is a firearm.
Let me follow up just a minute. That, I don't have a problem with the bill as written. I had no questions at it until I saw the Dash 1 amendment.
Understood.
But the Dash 1 amendment says includes mace, tear gas, pepper mace, or any similar deleterious agent as defined in ORS 163.211. I haven't really looked up what is in 163.211. But it would appear that on the one hand, your taser seems to be more of an offensive weapon, and some of these other things might be better construed as a defensive weapon, even against a dog or something.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I'm with the City of Medford, and actually the Dash 1 amendments were proposed by the City of Medford and did talk to everybody as far as the lobbyists beforehand, but didn't really think about these questions that were going to come up. And I certainly do not want to hold down this bill. The Chiefs of Police and I have a bill, House Bill 2536. I'm calling it the Modern Crimes Bill. What it does is really address this issue that as technology changes, as times change, we have new technology and new weapons that should in fact be considered in the law. Not only just weapons, but mailing a substance, a hazardous substance, as a disorderly conduct, using a look-alike firearm in a robbery. So we have this modern crimes bill, and I'm happy to have these questions and can certainly take them and address them in our bill. We just thought this was an easy addition here, that it too changes the overall relationship between a felon and a police officer. It puts my officers in danger. But it certainly is not something I would like to hold up this good bill with. So,
any other questions? I just want to put a couple of things on the record, Cindy. As Senator Wissett said, the more I think about this, I think there's a couple of things we want to, when you're having the other bill go forward, is to consider is, you know, how broad do we want to cast the net? I think there's some legitimate arguments when you think that a felon, and specifically a female felon, that may be someone that defrauded their employer of money because of a gambling addiction or whatever it may be, that is going would be, let's say, not able to carry mace or capstan or something like that in their defense for 15 years, because that's their prohibition for felons. I think that's just something that, policy-wise, I'm not saying it's not correct, but at this point, it's something I just think needs to be vetted and just discussed a little bit greater as that how broad that might be.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. And as a woman, when the good Senator Woodsup brought this up, I thought, oh my gosh, that's an excellent point. What do you have left to defend yourself? I don't think when those of us who talked about this amendment earlier in the week, when we talked about it, we thought of those implications, and I appreciate knowing those, and we'll certainly take them under advisement on the House bill. And I apologize for taking up your time with an amendment. Thank you to Senator Boquist for helping us with it. I don't think any of us assumed that it would cause some angst, but it has, and so done with it.
No, this is where we can have a little discussion and take it from there. Is there any other questions regarding either the bill itself or the dash ones? Thank you all very much.
Thank
Is
you.
There anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 251?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer, representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We have no position as it relates to Senate Bill 251, and I had no intention of testifying, only to indicate that we would want to... I haven't reviewed with my committee, but I think that my committee would share the concerns raised by Senator Whitsett with respect to the A1 amendment. So you're not working the A1 amendment today, is that it?
No, we're not.
Okay, thank you. Then we have no position with respect to the bill.
Is there anyone else that wanted to give testimony? If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 251. And the chair will entertain any motions at this time.
Mr. Chair, move SB 251 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves the bill, Senate Bill 251, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Okay.
And Senator Boquist will be our carry on this one. Thank you. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 251. And I believe the next one we have. Is Senate Bill 248. We'll open a public hearing on that bill. Thank you. Brad, come on back up.
Senate Bill 248 creates a default prohibition on the disclosure of personal information of victims and witnesses to youth offenders in juvenile proceedings. This has a dash one amendment that changes or adds some very minor language. However, we do not have the new fiscals for that.
All right, so today we can only take the testimony since we don't have all the paperwork. We would need to move it. But Brad, if you'd be so kind to sign in and give us the overview of the bill plus the dash ones, which I'm assuming are yours.
Yes, Senator Przanski and members of the committee, thank you again. My name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. This is Senate Bill 248. Currently, the Oregon statutes recognize the risk to victims by the disclosure of their personal information to defendants. This has been prohibited for several years now. In fact, I went to try and find when it was changed, and I think it's some 6-plus years ago or more, but I couldn't get the exact date. Currently, information related to victims, including how to find them, their addresses and phone numbers, is disclosed to defense counsel, and defense counsel has the ability to contact them and prepare, obviously, for trial or for a defense for a particular defendant. However, as I mentioned, for some time now in adult cases, defense counsel is prohibited from disclosing that personal information on victims to the defendant himself or herself. This is an effort by this body to protect victims from having their personal information disclosed and putting them at further risk. However, I should point out, in 2007, the legislature reviewed and a comprehensive bill was passed which embodied victims' rights into the Juvenile Delinquency Code. That had previously not been done, even though most juvenile departments were following what typically was protection of victims' rights provided for in the adult criminal statutes. This particular prohibition, which is included in the general criminal discovery statutes, was not included in those various changes to the Juvenile Delinquency Code, and thus this protection for the release of personal identifying information to juvenile offenders was not prohibited as it is with adults. We see this as basically a housekeeping measure. defense counsel currently have procedures in place whereby before providing, for example, police reports or other information that they copy for defendants, they routinely redact the personal identifying information on the victim, and then they provide that information to the defendant. This has been routine for some time now and has been in place. There is a provision whereby the court can review whether or not this information needs to be released to a defendant for the purposes of justice and due process, and I will tell you from my county that has rarely occurred. I point that out to say that rarely does a defendant need to have this personal identifying information on a victim in order for them to appropriately and adequately assist their counsel with their defense. Again, I see this as housekeeping. It merely brings the juvenile delinquency provisions in line with the adult protection provisions in the discovery statutes insofar as protecting victims' information.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Roquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just support the bill. I'm just, you made a comment in reference to normally this information goes to I guess, the defense counsel, and then this prohibits the defense counsel from releasing it. Is that correct?
Chair Przanski, Senator Roquist, and members of the committee, currently the if you are an adult criminal defendant, the discovery statutes already one, require giving up reports and other information to the defense, and already prohibit the defense attorney from providing personal identifier information of a victim to an adult defendant. So they're already doing that.
We'll follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So what we're saying is we're closing the loop, but we're closing the loop for the juvenile, the counsel representing the juvenile, the counsel representing the defendant in a juvenile case from releasing that information. Is that correct?
Senator, or Chair Przanski, Senator Roquist, members of the committee, yes, that's correct.
And just, I want to put one other thing on the record. Brad, just to confirm my understanding, if you have someone that's pro se representing themselves, that your office would basically redact that information, and then if they felt for some reason they needed it for their preparation, they would go to the court to get some type of authorization to have that identifier information released.
Correct. On a pro se defendant, we actually take the reports, redact that information, and provide the copy. I think it's fair to say that it is less frequent that you have an unrepresented juvenile criminal defendant than you would find in the adult system.
Senator Dinkfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on subsection C, sub B, C. Can you give an example of what that would entail, where it says the need for information cannot reasonably be met by other means?
Page 1, line 16.
Thank you.
Easier. Yeah. Chair Przanski, Senator Dinkfelder, members of the committee, that is the portion of the statute that allows the court to order the disclosure of the victim's personal identifying information to the defendant. And what the showing there would be that the youth offender and their attorney would have to show that that information is necessary for them to do the defense, and they can't get the information any other way other than by having the personal identifying information of the victim.
Okay.
I don't know if that answered your question.
Well, follow up. Is this consistent with what happens under with adult?
I think it parrots this adult discovery statute.
Okay.
All right, Chair Przanski, yes. You asked me to address the Dash 1 amendments, and I did not, and I don't have them in front of me. But as I recall, all it does is add not only for district attorney, but adds juvenile department to those listed as not providing this information, recognizing, as in my county, that the vast majority of cases handled by juvenile departments are without the intervention or active participation of a deputy district attorney. They're handled by the juvenile departments.
Right.
And so it just adds juvenile departments to that.
All right. Any other questions? Brad, thank you very much.
You.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 248? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. Since we don't have the paperwork, this will be set over for another day for a work session. I am going to take a moment and reopen the work session on Senate Bill 251. And for the sole purpose, I did receive this morning prior to our hearing a notice from the Oregon Council of Police Associations that they are in fact in support of Senate Bill 251. Mr. Delashma had another obligation, another committee. He asked me to put that on the record, so it's now on the record and will be part of the file. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 251, and we'll open up our last public hearing on Senate Bill 289.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 289 provides that an interpreter's translation is not hearsay. We do, in fact, have the statement track. There's no revenue and minimal fiscal, and it can be worked today.
All right, Brad, you're back up. And Gil, if you want to come on up, we only have two signed up at this point. We should let Gil go first, but, you know.
That works for me.
I'll defer.
Reserve for rebuttal. Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, again, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney and chair of the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. It should concern you, one, that we have that little exchange, but secondly, I brought a book with me, which is rare when I've come before you to testify. The Senate Bill 289 deals with expanding the hearsay exception in the Oregon Evidence Code. Currently, statutes provide for approximately 30 different exceptions to the hearsay rule, which would otherwise prohibit admissions of statements made outside of court. Each exception is well thought out and recognizes the inherent reliability of the statements. For example, a child's discussion of sexual abuse or physical abuse, that disclosure is subject to a hearsay exception, and that statement to a different person is admissible at trial. A domestic violence victim's initial statement to a police officer and their disclosure of injury is admissible as a hearsay exception. Statements to a medical doctor are admissible as hearsay exceptions, and the exceptions go on and on. In each case, the evidence code recognizes that the statements are inherently reliable based on the circumstances in which they have been given or the way they are kept. In an ever-diversifying culture such as we have, many individuals require the assistance of an interpreter. For example, and I'll give you a very real-world example that we see frequently. An officer arrives at a scene and finds a victim outside of a vehicle that has been involved in a crash. The officer asks the woman sitting by the vehicle if she's okay, and she looks somewhat confused at the officer. A teen sitting next to her says something in Chinese to the woman. She responds in Chinese, and the person says to the officer she thinks her arm is broken. Now, currently, that particular interpreted statement of the victim by the teen sitting next to her would be inadmissible for the purposes of trial. However, if the officer spoke Chinese and the woman said to him in Chinese, "I think my arm is broken," that statement would be admissible at trial. The issue here is one dealing with the role of and admissibility of statements that come through an interpreter. In State versus Rodriguez-Castillo, a case that came out within the last few months, specifically provided that statements to an interpreter are deemed to be double hearsay. So if I might, to explain this, many of you are fortunate not being lawyers, so let me see if I can explain to you what this means. If I give a statement to Ms. Meyer and you ask her what my statement was, that is hearsay. She is telling you what somebody said, a declarant outside of court. If I give the statement to Ms. Meyer and she tells it to Mr. Neely, and you ask Mr. Neely what was said by me, there is a hearsay for the statement from Ms. Meyer to Mr. Neely, and then there is a double or a second hearsay of my statement to Ms. Meyer. Rodriguez-Castillo case dealt with a situation where the officer made an inquiry and through an interpreter of a person, and the statement to the interpreter of, "I've been sexually abused," it was a child abuse case, "I've been sexually abused and what happened," was made to the interpreter, who then gave the information to the police officer. The Rodriguez-Castillo court deemed the interpreter's statement as hearsay, as well as the initial statement of the victim. So we ended up with double hearsay. And further said, in order for that to be admissible, we need to have an exception in the code for the hearsay from the victim to the interpreter, which we do, and a second hearsay exception from the interpreter to the officer, which we did not. There was no clear exception. The purpose of Senate Bill 289 is to recognize exactly what happens here. The interpreter is merely a, as argued by the state in Rodriguez-Castillo, is merely a language conduit. In other words, we're asking this person who understands the foreign language to tell us what the victim said. It is the same statement being interpreted now into a different language. What this does is allows us, or really sets forth that we treat, and this is most often with victims, we treat victims who speak English the same as we treat those who do not speak English and require the assistance of another person to communicate with the investigator, officer, medical personnel, and the like. That is what this does. I will tell you, this is how it's been interpreted until the Rodriguez-Castillo case. That's how it's always been interpreted. The challenge that the interpreter was another level of hearsay was seldom granted as a reason to suppress a statement or deem it inadmissible. Now, there is, Ms. Meyer has, I know through discussions with our folks, has raised some concerns related to, well, what about the qualifications of the interpreter? And I think those are reasonable questions to ask. Nothing about Senate Bill 289 would not allow what happens every day in court today. And let me see if I can give you an example of that. The officer comes into a domestic violence household, and a hysterical victim is explaining to the officer what happens, what happened. That statement made by the victim is admissible. However, at trial, skipping ahead now, it is not uncommon that defense counsel will challenge, one, the ability of the officer to have understood what the victim said, and secondly, to accurately relay it back to the trier of fact. There's nothing about this that would prevent the interpreter, the same type of challenge, to come before an interpreter. Their ability to understand what was being said and to relay it, albeit in a second language now, to relay that information back to the officer or other investigator in the English language versus the language that it was given to. I think that's appropriate. What that does, though, should not go to the admissibility of the statement. It goes to what weight a jury would ultimately put on it. Do we think that this interpreter accurately understood what was being said and relayed it accurately to the police officer? And I suppose, furthermore, it is now accurately relayed to the trier of fact, a jury or a judge. And just as defense counsel would argue, the officer didn't understand what they were saying or took it out of context or is not relaying it accurately, the same type of challenge would happen as I envision what 289 would do in trial as it would today with the original statement that is relayed as hearsay via one of the hearsay exceptions. 289, in its most simplistic terms, really says, because you need an interpreter, does not keep what is otherwise a well-recognized and valuable hearsay exception to get at truth, to get at justice, and we're going to let it in. It does not prevent defense counsel from appropriate challenges to the ability of the interpreter to understand and to relay.
Right. Yeah, before you give your testimony, I just want to put something on the record for clarification, and then you can respond to that, too, in your presentation. So, Brad, based on this court decision in Rodriguez-Castillo, it would make no difference if the person who was the interpreter was certified or not. The decision came out as being double hearsay because of how it was removed.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, that's correct.
All right.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Gail Meyer, representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I would submit at the outset that hearsay, exceptions to the hearsay rule, do have constitutional underpinnings because they do impact the defendant's right of cross-examination. And there's also a lot of significant policy determinations that underlie exceptions to the hearsay rule. So they're not, I don't think, easily enacted or enacted without consideration of those underpinnings. I would agree with Mr. Berry in one respect, and that is that exceptions to the hearsay rule rely upon the inherent reliability of the out-of-court statement. So in the Rodriguez case, again, you had the detective and you had the victim who was making a report of a sexual abuse allegation. That is a recognized exception to the hearsay rule. There is, quote, deemed to be inherent reliability in that out-of-court statement. And so that statement of the victim came within a hearsay exception. But it needed to be translated through the interpreter, and therein lied the double hearsay analysis. And there was no established exception for an interpreter, and that's the issue here in this bill. So the question posed is there inherent reliability in an interpreter's statement? Is it inherently reliable? And that breaks down to two things. Accuracy of translation, number one, and an absence of bias, number two. So as to the accuracy of the translation, what happens generally when an officer goes to a scene, there is no certified court interpreter there at the scene. So typically they do have to utilize just those who are present, those who are immediately present. Could be a neighbor, could be a family member, could it be just a companion, whatever. Someone who ostensibly speaks both languages. But it may not be absolutely accurate translation. I know some of what I speak here, and that in the tail end of my career when I was practicing, we were doing some maritime defense, and so we would actually have the engine crew of these ocean-going vessels come off, and they'd be subjected to questioning. And I found quickly that just because someone speaks Tagalog from Philippines doesn't mean you can get a Tagalog interpreter and have them understand one another. There are so many variances in dialect, even just casual language to formal language, that the accuracy of the translation is not always a given simply because two people consider themselves to be speaking the same language. So accuracy is one instance here where I would question if there's inherent reliability in an interpreter's statement. The second consideration as it relates to inherent reliability is that interpreter free from bias? So you're at the scene. You've got a victim saying something. What's the bias of the interpreter in relating that statement to the officer? If you have, here's just an example of what I'm trying to say. If you have a young child relating an allegation of sex abuse, the interpreter is the mother, who's the ex-wife of the defendant, and they're in a custody dispute. Can you necessarily say that that mother, being the interpreter, lacks bias in reporting the statement? So I would submit that, particularly in these out-in-the-field type encounters, that the statement of the interpreter does lack inherent bias, and that's the underpinning by which hearsay exceptions can be and should be enacted. With respect to the constitutional underpinnings, it's not yet been decided by the United States Supreme Court whether or not an interpreter statement comes within the Crawford analysis, but the Supreme Court has become very clear in recent years under the state of United States versus Crawford that hearsay has constitutional underpinnings for the criminal defendant because the criminal defendant has the right of cross-examination of its accusers. And so to have an interpreter not be present in the courtroom, not be subjected to cross-examination, really does impact that ability, particularly where, again, you're dealing with issues of accuracy and freedom from bias as to the report. So what's the state to do? Oh, one last point. I'm not entirely convinced in my own mind that Senate Bill 289 is absolutely fundamentally necessary for the state. One thing that they attempted to argue on appeal in the Rodriguez-Castillo case, but which had not been preserved at the trial court, was that they wanted to contend that there was a residual exception to the hearsay rule that would have allowed them to get this interpreter statement in. They did not preserve that at the trial court level. They tried to raise it for the first time on appeal, and the Supreme Court said, we're not going to consider this for the first time on appeal. But it seems to me it's definitely a viable option for them at the trial court level. So the bottom line is, what is the state to do when the officer comes to the scene and they encounter these statements that have to be interpreted through someone? I would submit the best thing, and it's the most practical thing for the state to do, is to flip out a little recorder and record any time, whether you're interviewing a defendant, accused, or you're taking a statement from a witness. You need to record it if it's coming through an interpreter. There is no way to preserve later whether that translation was accurate unless you are initially recording the declarant's words and statements. It's the only way you can analyze later whether or not that interpretation was accurate or free of bias. So I would submit that the most practical thing to do would be to simply record. Secondly, you could have the victim come into the courtroom and relate in first person instance on the stand what it is he or she said at the scene. That would be permissible. Third thing is to have the out-of-court translator there. The other option is to simply have that interpreter who was at the scene come into the courtroom in trial and testify as to what the victim said. Then you would come in within the hearsay exception. So if the interpreter at the scene were to come into court and say, the victim at the scene said X, and the victim's statements is within a hearsay exception, then it can be related by that interpreter at trial. So it's not as though here the state is lacking in options or lacking in remedies. They do have the ability to get those statements in, and I would just simply submit that crafting an exception that does not require a court-certified interpreter in all instances puts us on very thin ice in terms of the ability to know whether or not that translation was accurate and free from bias. And it would impact the defendant's constitutional rights, although I acknowledge there's no case on point right now.
Okay, Brad, before you respond, again, I want to put something on the record just to make sure everyone's on the same page. Normally in a trial, if the prosecutor is putting on this case, what I'm hearing is that you'd be relying on the police officer to be your witness, and he or she would be testifying as to what has been told to them through the interpreter as to the victim. They may not necessarily have the victim or the interpreter there.
Chair Brzezinski, yes. If I can explain a couple of things here, and I appreciate Ms. Meyer's testimony and the opportunity to respond briefly to that. First, the problem with the basic premise as that's laid out is it assumes that the victim at the time of trial is cooperative with the prosecution. Let's take cases of domestic violence, for example, and child sexual abuse, where between the time of the offense, where the victim says he punched me in the face or the child says he sexually touched me, and the time that we go to trial, now the victim has worked to get back together with the defendant. The child has now been pressured by the remaining custodial parent to back off of their statement and the like, and these are not made up examples. These happen every single day in the courts of the state, whereby victims of crime will try to recant what they have said before because of very logical reasons. If you look at the dynamics of family pressures that are placed on them, so it assumes that you have a cooperative victim, where many times we do not. Secondly, I might point out that Ms. Meyer has talked about where we don't have court-certified interpreters, and that's going to be the vast majority of the time. Officers don't go around with a certified interpreter in the right seat of their patrol car when they're doing cases. It would be impossible. I might also point out that there are many languages, and let me take one that is not uncommon, American Sign Language. There is no court certification process at all. So the argument that it should only be court certified, if that's in fact the argument being made, you would never have the circumstance where you have a court certified process for particular languages there. Now the other thing in discussing accuracy and bias, I think I addressed, but let me reiterate, if I may, briefly. One, accuracy: at any time the defense could challenge the ability of the interpreter to accurately understand and to relay what was said. Additionally, as far as bias, the argument there is no different than if it is a hearsay exception to the officer himself or herself. Do they have a bias? Is the statement of the victim to this third party, which would come in, do they have a bias to twist it? This is commonplace in our system, whereby defense counsel has the opportunity to challenge the interpreter and what they say based on the potential of bias. and it happens every day. All we're suggesting is that just because you convert from one language to another, that somehow it ought not to come in under the general hearsay exception that allowed the original statement to come in is just logical. It makes sense that it should come in. We're not suggesting defense counsel does not have an opportunity to question bias, to question accuracy, and it could be done. As far as the issue of whether or not this is a confrontation issue, the identity of the interpreter will be disclosed to the defense, and they certainly have the ability to call that person in, as they do with any other hearsay exception. So let's take the commonplace hearsay exception of a statement to an officer by a domestic violence victim within 24 hours. The defense, even though the statement comes in by the police officer, the defense has the opportunity to call the victim in and say, "Did you say that? Is it true? Was it accurate? What did you perceive?" Can make the same challenge there that they can. And there's nothing different about the proposal here from Senate Bill 289. One last thing I should point out is there are hearsay exceptions whereby you can't just call the interpreter in and have them testify. And the one I just gave you, the domestic violence hearsay exception within 24 hours, is to an investigator. The interpreter is not an investigator, and thus you would be relegated to the catch-all hearsay exception, which, as Ms. Meyer pointed out, was discussed and sent back for further discussion at the trial court level. But more importantly, because you don't speak English does not mean you should not have the protections of the hearsay exception to bring that information before the trier of fact, just because an interpreter relayed that information to the officer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Mr. Berry might have answered my question, but I need to back up just a little bit. It has to do with whether or not the interpreter is there in the court. And I'm having trouble figuring out how you establish the requirements of sufficient understanding of the language and sufficient understanding of English if you don't have the interpreter there. So when I read this, I envisioned that the interpreter would be there in order to be questioned to establish those, you know, in the courtroom to establish those requirements.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, I apologize for interrupting you, and members of the committee. No, the hearsay exception, when you have a hearsay exception as it is, it means that the declarant need not be in court at the time. However, nothing precludes the defense from bringing the declarant in, the interpreter in, to challenge their ability to understand and accurately interpret. So the challenge is there, the ability to confront the qualifications, using a broad word, of the interpreter is not defeated. It just requires that you bring the person in. They will have been identified to the defense as to who they are.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question. What happens in the situation where you have an officer who is bilingual and then hears and then translates him or herself? How does does this affect that situation, and what happens in those situations? I'm thinking of, for example, in some places in my district in Washington County where there's a pretty high level of diversity in lots of different languages, but I know that there are also some Spanish-speaking detectives. So what happens in that situation?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, and members of the committee, currently if a bilingual officer comes onto scene and speaks with someone in a foreign language, whatever it be, if there's a hearsay exception for that, let's go back to the domestic violence case, they would be allowed to testify as if it had been stated in English. In other words, we allow the officer to interpret, but currently, as the law is, we don't allow an interpreter to relay what a person said in a different language. So now if the officer comes in and speaks to the victim in Spanish for an hour, they would be allowed to come in at trial and in English state what the victim told them. Again, though, just as I stated before, defense counsel would be able to challenge the officer's ability to genuinely understand the other language, just as they would here by calling in the interpreter.
Thank you.
Gail.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Senator Bonamici, with respect to your questions, I would agree that if the officer is the translator, the officer will be at trial on the stand, and that's when the defense would have the opportunity to question their understanding of the language and the accuracy of the interpretation. With respect to whether or not the interpreter under this hearsay exception would have to be in court as well, I maintain that interpreter would need to be in court, and here's why. There's a preliminary determination of fact, which is a term of art under the evidence rules 104. A court would first have to make a determination of fact whether or not the interpreter has sufficient understanding of the language of the person, and whether or not the interpreter had a sufficient understanding of English. It's the proponent of the hearsay exception who has the burden of proving that. So I would maintain that as the rubber would hit the road here, it would be the state's obligation to call that interpreter into the courtroom to first establish to the judge these conditions of fact, these predicates, that there's a sufficient understanding of the language in English. So now that you have that interpreter there present in the courtroom, the question becomes, why not have that interpreter testify at trial simply as to what the victim said in the out-of-court statement that is covered with a hearsay exception? So I would maintain this bill doesn't really net the state all that much. As the proponent of the hearsay exception, they would have the burden of establishing the predicate facts that would entitle them to that hearsay exception, which would require the interpreter to be in court.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Boquist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, and I'll ask the first one, and then I'll follow up with that, because I think they're going to have to follow up afterwards, because I'm going to take bets here that I'm not going to get an answer. Could both individuals, both the district attorney and the defense lawyer's representation, could you define to me, under the United States Code, the difference between an interpreter and a translator?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, members of the committee, I don't know the U.S. code. I will be clear there. There is a difference in definition of translator and interpreter. An interpreter relates what they hear and responds in the second language as to what was said. A translator will actually move to paraphrase to this is what they mean. That's my understanding of the difference between the two.
Counsel.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski and Senator Boquist, my understanding is that the interpreter, which is the word we use for the court-certified interpreter, they use that phrase to interpreter, is that it is endeavors to be an exact word-for-word recital of what the other person is saying. Translation allows for flexibility in just communicating the essence.
Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, I guess my point here is I've been involved in probably more cases than anybody sitting in this room in this particular arena from my background, and still unfortunately involved in some of them under the U.S. Code, how that works. I understand the premise of needing to fix or do some adjustment here, but I'm really uncomfortable because I personally could testify to more than 1,000 deaths due to faulty interpretation and faulty translations. And that's personally firsthand. I'm aware of that, and which is much broader than domestic violence and so on and so forth. And this involves, you know, under the United States Code, and so I'm really a little uncomfortable with where we're at right now because it will have downrange implications.
I sense this from the committee, and what we're not going to do today is try to move the bill. I think there's going to need to have a little bit more discussion, allow the parties to maybe meet with individual members, and then the committee itself maybe with some work through council to make certain that we have whatever we might want to put before the committee in a work session together. So I'm going to, we have about 5 minutes before we need to be concluding today. Are there any other questions for either of these two? The only other thing I was going to just put on the record, and Ms. Meyer, this is more for you, as to your analysis of the inherent reliability, accuracy, and bias. A lot of that seems to me to be an area where it really goes to the weight of the evidence as to what a prior fact should be relying on in that perspective. And then I do want to make certain that it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, there's nothing that would in fact stop a defendant from calling the victim as well as an interpreter to the stand to actually raise these other issues that you've raised. Or is there something I'm missing as to
without the, I guess for the unavailability part, besides that, they would be subject to subpoena.
Chair Brzezinski, with respect to the unavailability part, the bill would put this exception into that provision of hearsay that basically says the availability is immaterial. So once it's in that evidence rule, I don't know that the defendant would have the right to say it should not come in simply if the defendant could not get the interpreter there. So that would be my concern with the way the bill is phrased. In an ideal world, the defense could. But again, I think that the way this, the rubber's going to hit the road here, the proponent of the hearsay exception has the burden of establishing the exception, and I think it's going to be the state's burden.
I understand.
Yeah.
Closing.
Thank you, Chair.
You need to get rebuttal.
thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Just one thing. We can respectfully disagree on how this procedurally would work today, but I do want to point out one thing, that even if the interpreter is present in court, the admissibility of the statement still has to come in with a basis of a hearsay exception. Mm-hmm. We would have to have it twofold then, for the interpreter as well as for the victim's original statement. And this addresses that issue, that it would not require that secondary hearsay exception.
Right.
So, rebuttal?
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. I just want to be understood. If that interpreter were present at trial, that interpreter could say, at the scene, the victim said X.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And that would supposedly take away the double hearsay. All right. Any other questions? Any other closing comments? Committee, thank you very much. And we are scheduled to meet tomorrow at 8:30. And we'll conclude for today and be adjourned.